Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking a bit about the history of a company now that has really become synonymous with computer animation, and that is Pixar. Now has made a number of films, have been very, very successful, both commercially and critically. But there certainly would have been a time when you wouldn't have thought that that would happen, when the future of Pixar really looked in question. In the early years, in fact, Pixar, it was not a computer animation company. It was a computer company. And before it became an animation studio, Pixar went through many years of struggle and many years of multi-million dollar losses. How it happened to turn around, and how it is that who it is that made this possible, the subject of a book that we'll be talking about this morning. The title of the book is The Pixar Touch. The subtitle is The Making of a Company. And our guest is the author. His name is David Price. He'll be talking with us here this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions, comments are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions welcome. We just ask people to try to keep their comments brief so we can get in as many as possible. But certainly anybody is welcome to call. The book is out now. It's published by Knopf. So if you'd like to read it, you can certainly, I'm sure, find it in the bookstore. And again, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers to call. Mr. Price, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Sure.
I'm interested in maybe starting out to talk a little bit about the most recent Pixar movie. And it's certainly on my mind because I just happened to see it this past weekend, WALL-E. And I thought that it was very good. I liked it, and certainly critics have spoken very highly of it. But I had this experience. I went to the theater, and I went to an afternoon show. It was 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And there was a good crowd there. And a lot of people had brought small children. And it became real obvious real quick that they didn't get it at all. Mm-hmm. And I started thinking, well, now that's very interesting. Now, this movie, maybe more in a way unlike some of the other movies, is really a movie for adults. This is a grown-up picture. I started wondering, you know, was this a deliberate choice? Did it just work out that way? Does this say something about where the people at Pixar think that they're going by making a movie like this that maybe kids on some level can appreciate, but I think the themes are very much adult themes.
Well, I think you're really on target there. I had a similar experience taking my two boys, who are 8 and 10, to see it the weekend that it came out. And one of them liked it, and one of them really didn't care for it at all. And I think talking with other parents and their children, I do feel that it's probably the least child-friendly mm-hmm. of any of Pixar's 9 feature films so far. Not that there's anything inappropriate in it, but it really is centered on, I think, adult themes. The pacing is probably more adult-friendly than child-friendly. It becomes, in the middle and the end, it becomes fairly deliberate in its pacing, if that's a good way to put it. So, yes, I think it is probably their most adult-centric film so far. Interesting how they promoted it. I mean, if you don't really get a sense of that looking at the trailers, which mm-hmm. draw a lot from the first third of the movie, which is very sort of cutesy and comical and so on. They've always tried to pitch movies to the whole audience. In other words, they want family movies that are fun for the kids to watch, fun for the adults, that work on both levels. I think this is the first one that really works best, at least, on just the adult level.
Yeah. Well, and certainly the other movies that I have watched, I've seen everything they've ever done, but I think I've seen another number of these movies and enjoyed them all. They were a lot of fun, and I could certainly see that many of them, movies like Toy Stories and Monsters, Inc., that probably children of a reasonable age wouldn't have any problem getting into them, and certainly anything that's got sort of slapstick comic action, that's going to be a big hit. But I just thought, now this is interesting. This is very different, very good, but very different.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And you asked, well, is this defining a new direction for Pixar? I don't think that that's necessarily the case. When you look at their slate that's coming up, certainly on the face of it, it seems like they're going back more to the traditional model they've had of fun for adults, fun for children. I don't know that they're necessarily taking things in a different direction, but they definitely did take it in a different direction this time out.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk about how it is that Pixar got started, and it existed in a form before it was even called Pixar. And this is a story that's really, it's a story of the people that made that made the company. Three, I guess, in particular, and of course there are a lot of other people who are important in this story. Starting with Ed Catmull, and I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly. This is a fellow who studied computer science at the University of Utah, which interestingly enough, apparently a lot of people who went on to be very influential in computer graphics were there at Utah. He was somebody who wanted to work for Disney, but knew that he couldn't draw. So he apparently had this idea, well, why not use computers? Why not take computer graphics and use those to do animated films?
That's right. As part of my research for the book, I wound up spending some time with Ed Catmull's senior year high school yearbook, and you see him having this remarkable range of interests for a guy his age. He's in the math and science club at the same time. He's in the drama club. He's captain of the debate team. He realizes, as you said, that he doesn't have the skills, the drawing skills, to be a Disney animator, which is what he has his sights on. So he goes into computer science in the very early years of computer science as a discipline, studies in graduate school computer animation at a time when that's really at the lunatic fringe. I spoke with one of his classmates in his PhD program who talked about how it was a struggle just to get a high-quality still image out of a computer, let alone to be thinking in terms of 24 frames per second animation.
Yeah. He was hired to go out to New York to take part in something called the New York Institute of Technology, where the guy who started that wanted to get into movie making, I guess, or was interested in computer animation. And he and the team that went there, those are the people that became Pixar and formed the core group of Pixar. How did that come about? What was he doing, and how did he end up in Long Island working in this computer graphics lab?
Well, the head of this institution, NYIT, was a splendid, rich eccentric named Alex Shore, and he had gotten bitten by the Hollywood bug, and so he'd hired a bunch of animators, traditional animators, to work on a movie for him on Long Island, and he was the director of the movie. Watching these animators do all the hand drawing, it's a meticulous process, he became convinced that computers could do all that, that he could replace his animators with computers, which of course isn't how it works, actually. But he had a germ of a good idea, which is to try to apply computer graphics to animation. So he's really out there ahead of everybody at this point, and he goes calling to the University of Utah, which is where a lot of computer graphics work is being done, and buys a lot of the hardware that he needs from a company that's also located there, and he asks who he should hire, and he's given Ed Catmull's name. He's flown out there. He's given the job as the first director of the computer graphics research lab that this guy is starting. And then Ed Catmull begins hiring some of the other people who become, down the road, become the nucleus of Pixar when it finally starts.
Mm. One of these people who is also important here, who joins early on, and I think was part of this team at the NYIT, is Alvy Ray Smith. Tell me about him.
Right. Alvy was another of these polymaths. He was an artist and very interested in art and accomplished as an artist. And at the same time, he was a mathematician. He had a PhD from Stanford. He was introduced to one of the first computer paint programs of the kind that we all have on our computers, a very simple kind of paint program, just falls in love with the possibilities. He just loves the idea of creating art with a computer, which was sort of a hard concept for people to understand back then. Mm-hmm. And so he's working at a research center doing this called Xerox PARC, Palo Alto Research Center. And that's how he becomes immersed in computer graphics. Xerox shuts down this effort. They decide that they're not going to do color anymore. They decide that the future is in black and white, not color. And so he and a friend of his go to Utah to see if they can get access to a computer to do more computer art. And they say, well, we don't have anything for you here, but you know, this guy, Alex Shore in Long Island, has hired Ed Catmull. Why don't you try to connect with them? So it's this very roundabout road that gets him in league with Ed Catmull. And they're the sort of the number one and number two guys in the future Pixar.
Mm-hmm. There's another person here who's important. We talked earlier about how Ed Catmull really had wanted to work for Disney but felt that he couldn't draw well enough. Another guy who's important here is a fellow named John Lasseter, who actually did work for Disney.
Yes, that's exactly right. John became interested in animation as a career when he saw a book about animation in his high school library during his sophomore year of high school. And he winds up going to the first year of the character animation program at a school called the California Institute of the Arts. This program was to be a feeder into Disney animation. He goes to work for Disney after he graduates, and he finds that Disney has just gone to seed since he was growing up. That Walt Disney has passed away now. The company's being run by a set of caretaker managers who are not doing a very good job of keeping the quality high. There's a very low morale there, and so he it's this terrible thing. He his dream comes true, but then when he gets there, it's just this terrible disappointment to him and to a lot of other people who join at the same time. He agitates to bring computer animation into Disney because he sees some early footage from a film called Tron. This is a movie that comes out in 1982, which has about 15 minutes of computer animation in it. It's about youths who battle evil within a video game. And so he sees this early footage, and he starts lobbying for Disney Animation to try to do some computer animation work, and for his trouble, he gets fired. He made some mistakes politically in doing this, and so he finds himself out on the street. He's at this point made a connection with the Pixar people, the future Pixar people. They're now based at Lucasfilm in California. George Lucas has hired them to do some work for him, and so that's how he makes the connection. He's fired. When Ed Catmull finds out about this, he phones Alvey and says, "You know, I was just chatting with John, and he's available." And Alvey says, "No, put the phone down right now and hire him. Don't waste a minute." And so that's how they get together.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is David Price. He is the author of a newly published book that looks at the history of Pixar. The title of the book is The Pixar Touch. It's published by Knopf. It's out in the bookstore now if you want to take a look at it. He's written for a number of publications, including The Wall Street Journal, Investor's Business Daily, Washington Post, Forbes, and Inc. He's also the author of another book, Love and Hate in Jamestown. He makes his home in Washington, D.C. He's joining us this morning by phone. Questions welcome, 333-9455. and toll-free, 800-222-9455. So as you mentioned, a lot of these guys that were formed the creative core of Pixar, before it was Pixar, working for this guy in Long Island. And then they first, Ed Catmull was hired by George Lucas. And right. Then eventually he managed to take everybody else with him, much to the distress of Alex Scherr, who had put the team together there at NYIT. And yeah. You'd think if anybody would see the possibilities for computer animation, it would be somebody like George Lucas. But it seems that once they got there at his place, they didn't know what to do with them.
That's right. I mean, George Lucas is this creative genius. This is when he's fresh off of the success of the first Star Wars movie in the late 1970s, and he wants to start a computer graphics group within his organization. When I say computer graphics group, I mean a computer group to do work on things like digital film editing, digital sound editing. He wants tools to help him make live-action movies, like the Star Wars movies. He really doesn't have computer animation on his radar. The problem is that computer animation just wasn't very far along at that point. It was a little primitive in some ways, and he wasn't able to see where it could go. So his feeling was, you know, these are my computer guys. I don't want them doing filmmaking. They're here to help me do filmmaking. Hmm. And this is what causes a real divergence in paths in the mid-1980s, in 1985, when he decides to spin the group off into a separate company to sell it off. Hmm.
It's interesting to hear that as you say, that Lucas brought these guys out to work for him, essentially, and not particularly to do computer animation, which is what they really wanted to do. And it turns out that maybe the first sort of significant bit of computer animation that they did, or at least something that they did that ended up in a feature film, it wasn't for George Lucas.
That's right. George Lucas has probably the world's most outstanding collection of computer animation talent, but he's not using them. Steven Spielberg and some others outside of Lucasfilm see the potential, and so they wind up going to work on their first feature film project, which is a bit of animation for a movie called Young Sherlock Holmes. They animate a stained glass knight who comes alive within a stained glass window, jumps down into the church and terrifies a priest. And so it's the first feature film work that they've done, and it's an effect that holds up very well today. I mean, the film isn't watched very much anymore, but this particular sequence of it is really quite striking when you think that it's being done in the mid 1980s. They do make a short film while they're under George Lucas's umbrella called The Adventures of Andre and Wally B., which is shown at a technical conference called SIGGRAPH in 1984. George Lucas goes to see it because his girlfriend Linda Ronstadt happens to be doing a concert in the same city at the same time. And so he takes a look at the movie, and he reacts very coldly to it. I mean, he basically, I think correctly, sees that, you know, it's kind of mediocre as a story. It's a very simple-minded production. But again, I think what he wasn't able to see was the potential.
Certainly, one of the, if you look at the people who are really important in the history of Pixar, one of the big names has to be Steve Jobs, the Apple computer guy. He comes into the picture here at a time when he was forced out of Apple. He still had plenty of money, though, he was still interested in computers. Lucas was at the time going through a divorce, and he needed money, so he decided to sell off the computer graphics division, which I think at this point was actually called Pixar. Jobs bought it, paid $5 million for it in 1986. What did Steve Jobs want with Pixar?
Steve Jobs is very canny about how he goes about this. He sees them, this group of about 40 people, as something that he could turn into another computer company. He's just been fired from the company that he co-founded, Apple Computer, and he has money. He wants to prove himself. He doesn't want to be seen by his peers in the Valley as a one-hit wonder. So he needs another success story. He's starting a company called Next. That's one of his projects. Pixar becomes his other project. There's a long road in Lucasfilm and Steve Jobs getting to this point. Lucasfilm wants more money. They're shopping this group all over the place. Computer hardware companies, investment banks, venture capital firms. I saw the list. There's about two dozen different places that George Lucas's executives shopped Pixar to, and everyone turned them down. So as a last resort, they sold it to Steve Jobs for a third of the asking price. And so in early 1986, Pixar is spun off as Pixar Inc., and it becomes a computer company. While they were working for George Lucas, they created a very sophisticated computer for high-end graphics, and that was to be the product that they would sell. Steve Jobs' vision was that he and this company of his would populate the world with Pixar image computers. That's what the box was called, and that would be his next success story after Apple.
So what happened here? Because the computer, apparently, their software was really good, and people still use their software, but the computer itself was kind of a flop. Was it not a good product, or was it something that that at the time that there just wasn't the demand and the market for?
This is a really rough period for Steve Jobs. I mean, people don't remember his years in the wilderness, but that's really what it was like for him during the mid-'80s to into the mid-'90s. The computer is very good at what it does, which is high-speed graphics processing. It's also expensive, around $125,000, and customers just don't perceive it as solving a problem that's worth spending $125,000 to solve. They tried to get it into hospitals and medical research, and people just weren't interested. They were happy doing looking at images the old-fashioned way at that time. Pixar later goes into the software business, selling graphics software. Their stuff, once again, is very good and technically very successful. Steve Jobs' vision is that every man, people like you and I, would be creating beautifully crafted 3D images on our computers for business graphics and designs and all the rest, and they'd be spewing out of our laser printers. And that never happened. I mean, this stuff was tough, even for PhDs to work on, and it was really not a product that was ready for every man, and it for the most part isn't today. So it's a technical success, and it's very well received by special effects houses. To this day, it is the number one rendering software for special effects in the movies that we see. But it never took off the way that Steve was hoping it would.
Well, one thing certainly you got to give him is that for many years after he bought Pixar, it lost money. And he continued to put his money into it and to continue to – perhaps the thing was he believed enough in the goal so that he figured sooner or later things would turn around. But for a long time – Pixar lost money, and it just he kept it going because he put his own money into it.
That's right. I think it's really almost a unique situation. I think if Pixar had been owned by anyone else, by any venture capital investor, it would have been shut down years earlier. But yes, year after year, Steve Jobs is putting millions of dollars of his own money into it, taking out loans with his personal guarantee to keep it going. And I think part of it is that Steve was optimistic that things would turn around, that you know, maybe the market wasn't ready for it now, but in a couple of years it will be. And I think part of it, too, was he didn't want to be perceived as a failure. I mean, he was very unhappy about how things went at Apple. And if you talk to people who were, you know, close to him at the time, professionally, they'll tell you that he, you know, clearly didn't want to go down in flames twice in a row. And so there's mixed motives for keeping the company going, but he does keep the company going, and that's what makes all the difference.
Yeah. Again, we're a little bit past our midpoint here. I just want to introduce again our guest, David Price. He's the author of the book, The Pixar Touch, The Making of a Company, which is about the history of the Pixar, the computer animation giant, now giant, but at one time certainly it didn't look like they would be. His book is just recently out. It's published by Knopf. Questions, welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. It seems like in that period there that still the guys who were some of the people we've talked about and the guys who were there at Pixar still really believed, you know, and as much as they might have believed in themselves as a computer company, they still, it seems like they really wanted to do computer animation, even if what they were doing was they did some commercial product and then they did some other things just to show what they could do. And maybe some people, that the thing that I think of as being the first Pixar, or maybe the first time I became aware of Pixar, is Luxo Jr.
Yeah.
This is the with the two desk lamps. And mm-hmm. and still, it's still part of their logo. It's Luxo Jr. comes out in, at the beginning of the movie. So maybe people know about that. That was a that was an animated short that they did, basically just to show what they could do. And I would think that some people seeing it maybe would have gotten very jazzed and seen that and thought, well, you know, that's, we got something here. Maybe it's not everything that it could be, but we've got something here, and it's something that could really be big.
That's right. Well, there's a huge leap from the Andre and Wally B movie that they do under Lucasfilm in 1984, and Luxo Jr. that they show in 86. I mean, Luxo Jr. is just hangs together. You have to understand where computer graphics was in the mid 1980s. You would go to a technical conference. There'd be a theater that would show short films the different people were doing, but they weren't real films the way we'd think about them. For the most part, what you saw were these demos where logos would swirl around in space, or these very abstract artistic exercises that a lot of people found more irritating than anything else. So John Lasseter and the whole Pixar group were really the first to successfully tell stories with this medium. And so when a film like Luxo Jr. would show, these engineer types in the audience would just go wild. I mean, there'd be standing ovations because it was just something that they'd never seen anyone do before in computer graphics. Now, where these short films came from is that they were originally justified as promoting the Pixar image computer. The guys who were doing the work, Ed Catmull, Alvy Ray-Smith, John Lasseter, all the rest, believed very strongly in the idea of doing computer animation, of being the next Walt Disney company when the technology was ready for them. And so this was their way of keeping that alive. The way they justified it was, as I said, as a promotional tool. And so you'd have all these engineers building computers and designing computers and software, and then literally working out of a hallway, there was John Lasseter and a couple of technical guys working on these short films, which nobody expected to make any money. I mean, they were purely product commercials. The idea was that you would see Luxo Jr. or Red's Dream or Tin Toy, and you'd say, wow, that's really cool stuff. If I buy Pixar software, I can do stuff like that.
The thing that really turned things around, that, that put Pixar on the map, was Toy Story.
Mm-hmm.
And that I think maybe really impressed a lot of people with what you could do technically, and also how you could use that to tell a story. And as you say, that's really the key. You can't just have cool stuff to look at. Really, if you want to get people's attention and keep it, you actually also have to have a good story as well, mm-hmm. which that does. How was it that Pixar became associated with Disney?
Well, there were a couple things going on. For one, they were doing some consulting work or contract work for Disney Animation. They were able to help Disney computerize some of the production processes for doing traditional movies, cell animated movies. Basically, they were able to computerize the inking and painting process. So instead of having battalions of people who were inking and painting cells by hand, it was all done by computer. So they had that association with them, and they were able to carry out this project very successfully, and that gave them a lot of credibility. But probably more important than that is the short films we were just talking about. Luxo Jr., Tintoy, they'd win all these awards, and every time that happened, John Lasseter would get a phone call from the head of the Disney Studios. Jeffrey Katzenberg took over when Michael Eisner came in 1984. So John Lasseter's getting job offers to come back to Disney. Remember, he's been fired from Disney in 83, and now they want him back as a director. And he keeps saying no, because even though he's not making that much money at Pixar, and they're always cash-strapped, the company itself perennially seems like it's, you know, on the verge of going under. He has this sixth sense that if he stays at Pixar, he can make history, and that's what he does.
This relationship here between Disney and Pixar was that Pixar, they made the movies and Disney did the marketing and the distribution, and then they split the profits. And I'm sure that there must have been people at Pixar who thought, wait a minute here, we're making the movies. All they're doing is doing the distribution. Why should they be getting half the profits?
Well, you know, it's funny, but it was almost the other way around, because when Pixar and Disney's started talking about doing a movie together, Pixar was really the one beseeching Disney, almost. I mean, when the conversation with Disney started in 1991, the Pixar folks wanted to give themselves better bargaining power. So they went around to some of the other studios. Ralph Guggenheim, the producer of Toy Story, told me how they went to Columbia, Universal, all the major studios, and one by one, every other studio turned them down. If you can imagine that, everybody's turning down Toy Story. And so for them, Disney's the only game in town, and they don't really have any real standing to insist on anything. I mean, they're basically taking the terms that are given to them, which are for Toy Story, are very one-sided. It gets better for them as time goes on with the other movies. But for Toy Story, they really have to give away the story to be able to make the movie.
What did Disney have, what sort of impact, or did they have impact creatively speaking? So essentially the question is, was Toy Story a better movie because Disney was involved than it would have been if, you know, somebody else was doing the marketing and then the distribution?
Yes. It did make a difference. Now, Disney becomes less involved creatively in the movies after Toy Story, but they were very much involved creatively in Toy Story, and I think Disney learned a lot from Pixar, and Pixar learned a lot from Disney. The first story that the Pixar folks turned in, the first treatment that they turned in, was very, I'd almost say, juvenile. I mean, when you read it, it reads almost like a very simple little child story. And then they get a direction from Disney to make it edgier, to make it, you know, more adult. And then they wind up going in the other direction, and it evolves into this movie where Woody, the cowboy, is very mean to the point where the movie's almost unwatchable, and so it takes a long and then finally they wind up with a lot of direction from Disney as well as outside screenwriters that Disney hires and brings in. They do wind up with a really sparkling story that you see in the movie. So there was a long process that I think they learned a lot from.
And as a result of that, were better storytellers than they were before?
Yes, and they did very clearly take a lot away from that experience in terms of their understanding of storytelling, their understanding of the need to keep going until it's right. That's something. That's a process that you see in all the movies that come after Toy Story, is an unwillingness to be satisfied with the first effort, a willingness to be self-critical and to keep going.
Well, when we come down to the point where Disney actually buys Pixar, what is it that both sides are interested in here? And it seems like that on the one hand, the Pixar people were really interested in independence, mm-hmm. and the Disney people, if they just wanted to make money, I don't know, would they really have had to buy Pixar to continue to have that be a money-making proposition for them? I mean, what was in it for everybody here?
Well, you're hitting on a really important point here. What's easy to forget is that what Disney got for the $7.4 billion that it paid, $6.3 billion if you take away the cash on hand that Pixar had in the bank, the $6.3 billion, it was really not that much. Disney already had the right to distribute the movies that had already been made up to that point, up through Cars. They had the merchandising rights, the theme park rights, and so on. So what they're buying with that $6.3 billion is the continued services of the people working at Pixar. And but that was important to them because at that time, this was in 2006 now, Disney Animation had fallen on hard times again. I mean, Pixar was responsible at one point for as much as 45% of the income for Disney filmmaking. Disney's own animated movies were not doing well at all. I mean, critically or commercially. You might remember Treasure Planet and some of the others mm-hmm. like that. So they just need creative talent. They have a new CEO, Bob Iger, who needs to make some kind of bold stroke to send a signal that he's going to turn things around. So this, it serves Disney's, it's expensive by any measure, but I think Disney had to do something to show that animation at Disney wasn't going to die on the vine.
One other thing, detail about this sale, and this again goes back to Steve Jobs, was how much money this man, he already had a lot of money, but he made a spectacular amount of money off of the sale of Pixar, much more than he made out of Apple.
That's right. That's right. The IPO for Pixar in 1995 is what makes Steve Jobs a billionaire for the first time. Not Apple, Pixar.
And it also got him a seat on the Disney board and made him the single largest stockholder. He had more stock than Roy Disney had.
That's right. When the acquisition happens, yes, he ends up with, I think, 7% of the Disney shares versus, I think, around 1% for Roy Disney. So, it's an amazing reversal of fortune for Steve Jobs.
Mm-hmm. And he's presumably he is still on the board of directors of Disney.
Yes, he is.
Yeah. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Again, our guest is David Price. We're talking about Pixar, the animation company, and its history. That's the story that he tells in the book, The Pixar Touch, The Making of a Company. It's published by Knopf. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I think, you know, perhaps, I don't know if we buried the lead here or not. I think maybe the kind of thing that a lot of people would be interested in is Pixar is some kind of discussion of how in the heck they do that. And I don't know to what level you can get into that, but I guess it certainly is true. If you look at what they've done over the years, you can see how technically they've advanced in what kind of images they can create, what they can make things look like. And they've gone to the point when what they really could do really well was hard things, hard, shiny things. And then they got to the point where they could really do soft, furry things, and it is remarkable what it is that they can do, and how good the things that they make actually look.
Mm-hmm. No, you're right. I think there's a couple of stories there. I mean, on the technical side, they've always been on the forefront within feature filmmaking in the technical quality of computer animation. Even starting with their years at Lucasfilm, they've been able to trade on the status of working with the top computer graphics group. When they were at Lucasfilm, when they were a separate company, they were a place that if you were doing computer graphics, you wanted to work there because that was where you could do the most interesting work, the most cutting-edge work. It wasn't necessarily where you would make the most money, but it was still the place where you wanted to be. And then creatively, they've developed a process which I think evolved from their experience with Toy Story of, number one, being self-critical, of trusting the story process, of keeping at it until the story's reached the level it needs to be at. They have what's called a brain trust, which is their top directors and their top story people who get together periodically and comment on works in progress and give critiques on each other's work. And it's all, obviously, it's a constructive thing. It's not a political thing. But it's a setting where if you're working on a project, you can get probably the best quality feedback that you could get anywhere.
If you watch one of their movies and you sit there through the end and you watch the credits go, one of the things you realize is that this is the product of the combined efforts of a whole lot of people.
Yeah.
This is a very labor-intensive process to make a movie like this. With one of these movies, is it possible to say sort of in round figures how many person hours go into making a movie like this, how much labor it actually takes?
You know, it's funny. I've never worked out in terms of person hours. I mean, the sizes of the teams grow with every movie as they become more ambitious in what they're doing, and as the imagery becomes more involved. But I mean, there's no doubt. I mean, it's meticulous work. I had the opportunity to talk. If you think about Toy Story, I think for me the most emotionally charged part of it was the scene at the gas station where Buzz, the astronaut, and Woody the cowboy are confronting each other under the truck. And I spoke later with the animator who animated Woody for that scene, and he walked me through just the little choices that he was making. Things just like on the level of, you know, which the blink, the eye darts. Just every little thing. I mean, nothing's free in computer animation. Everything's a choice that somebody has to make. And that's what makes it really a monumental process to get one of these things put together.
Mm. Well, we have a couple minutes left. We have a caller here. Let's talk with them. Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi. I'm struck by you were talking about what Disney offered Pixar, and you said they helped a lot in some subtle ways. You didn't give any examples. And then you went to talking about what a bad track record Disney had in doing any animated films. So how could Pixar learn anything? It seems to me that Disney is more of a trophy on Jobs' shelf than actually and some Hollywood cred, I guess, which is non-commodifiable in some way for Pixar than anything else. What do you think of that? Is that clear?
Yeah, no, it is. I mean, I guess, so you're saying, well, isn't it kind of contradictory to say that, or unpersuasive to say that Pixar was learning from Disney at a time when, you know, Disney's own track record in animation was as bad as it was. And I mean, I think it would be interesting to explore, you know, how movies like Treasure Planet and some of the others turned out to be as weak as they were. And it may be decisions being made at the middle management level, I don't know. But certainly when you look at the making of Toy Story, which is where Disney had the most involvement, there were artists and story people from Disney who spent time talking with people at Pixar, giving them advice. Just to give you one concrete example,
is this from Lasseter himself, or are you citing the Disney people that said that we helped, or are you?
Oh no, this is testimony from Lasseter. This is, you know, there are multiple people who were parties to these meetings who. The particular example I was going to mention was figuring out what Buzz Lightyear sees inside the crane. You remember Pete the Planet? We're sort of getting into nitty gritty of the movie.
Yeah, only vaguely.
So there were all these ideas that had been tried and rejected for what he was going to find when he gets inside this crane game at Pete the Planet. And it was Disney people who, in a brainstorming session, came up with the idea of the aliens and the, you know, the cult of the claw and so on. A Disney guy named Chris Sanders designed the three-eyed alien. So I mean, there was that's kind of a small example, but there was some give and take, and I think Pixar learned from Disney, and as I said, Disney learned from Pixar.
Mm. Well, I'm not. I think
doesn't sound like you buy it.
I don't particularly, because how, if they were so good at it, why didn't they do it for whatever Treasure Planet? You know, why didn't they? Maybe it was too much upper executive oversight, and they broke free of it when they were collaborating with Pixar or something. I don't know what to make of it, and I don't know how corporations work particularly, but I don't think they're the most creative place.
Well, now, I mean, I think we need to be. Real clear here about the timelines, because a Treasure Planet and the other movies that I was talking about come at a later period. Jeffrey Katzenberg is in charge of Disney feature animation and Disney filmmaking in general from 84 until 94 when he leaves, and that's the period when Toy Story is being developed. It's also the period, sort of the second golden age of Disney animation, when you have The Lion King, The Little Mermaid, and all the rest. And then after he leaves, there is, I think, another real dry period, and that's when you have Treasure Planet and some of the others that weren't very satisfying. So I think when you sort of break down the chronology of you know, what's happening when, I think you can. I think it does make maybe a little bit more sense, or I hope it makes more sense.
We're just about the point we have to finish. We have a minute or two left. I'm sure that the people at Pixar, when they make a movie, what they want the viewers to do is to be absorbed by the movie and the story. They really don't want people to be taken out of the picture by sitting there and looking at that and thinking, dang, what an amazing thing that they could do this. I mean,
right.
you don't want to have people concentrating on the technical trick. You just want them to be absorbed in the story. At the same time, I wonder, do they want people at some level to appreciate the technical trick? Or do they say, you know, we don't care. We don't want people to even think about that. We just want them to have a great experience watching the movie.
Well, there's sort of, they want it to work on a level where you're appreciating it in the back of your mind, but it's not something that yanks you out of the picture. If you come away thinking that WALL-E is, you know, a beautifully made film, which was a great story, they're happy. If you come away from the movie thinking, wow, how did they keep, you know, WALL-E, you know, keep his tracks rolling on the ground the way they did, then they failed. So they don't. They basically they want it to be. They do very much want the movies to be appreciated artistically. Just they at the same time want some of the technical accomplishments not to be something that you're thinking about.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever think that we'll see a time when, for something like, let's say, the Academy Awards, that an animated film would be considered as a film with films with live actors, or is this always going to be a separate category?
Well, that's something that's quite a subject of great interest within the field of animation. As well, mm-hmm. Why can't animated movies just be treated as movies? The reality historically in the marketplace has been that there's a lot of pressure on animated movies to succeed as family films, and I think that makes it perhaps a little bit harder for them to compete with the full spectrum of movies that are out there for Best Picture. I mean, this year may be the exception. We'll see.
Hmm. And are there still the guys at Pixar, with all of the amazing things that they can do, are there still things that they want to be able to do? Do they look at the movie and as highly technically polished as WALL-E is, they look at that and say, well, you know, but there's so much more that we would want to be doing?
Well, in the making of The Incredibles, there is a lot of contention between Brad Bird on one hand, the director of that movie, and the producer who had budget responsibility on the other, as far as, you know, what effects they could put in, what scenes they could include or not include. I mean, as amazing as the films look on the screen, there are always trade-offs that have to be made. I mean, no one's signing any blank checks over there.
Well, we're going to have to stop. We're here at the end of the time. You want to read more, look for the book, The Pixar Touch, The Making of a Company, published by Knopf, by our guest, David Price. He's written for a number of different publications, among them The Wall Street Journal, Forbes, Washington Post, and Business Daily. Mr. Price, thanks very much.
Well, thank you.